Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Aerospace Advantage. I'm Lieutenant Colonel Retired John Slickbaum, and today we'll discuss Operation Desert Storm from the cockpit. We're going to talk to the airman who actually made it all happen. And this is so important because strategy and operational concepts are crucial, but it ultimately comes down to a person strapping into a jet and flying the actual mission. This takes tremendous skill and involves risk, and it requires a huge amount of determination. And it also takes a team. No airman or jet wins the war alone. It's a collection of mission areas, tactics, techniques, and procedures brought together at the right time and the right place to get the job done. Now, let's get real here. The last major war the United States executed at this point was Vietnam, which, despite the tremendous bravery at the individual level, was a failure strategically. So airmen had a lot on their shoulders. They were in this to fly, fight, and win. They didn't want to repeat things like Rolling Thunder and other botched efforts from the past. They spent the 1970s and 1980s learning the lessons of Vietnam and then applying them with vastly improved training, operational concepts, and tools in the form of better aircraft, weapons, and much, much more. Today's episode is going to center around a handful of airmen who represent different aspects of the air war. Joining us are F-16 pilot Lieutenant General Orville Wright, B-52 pilot Lieutenant General Mike Moeller, F-117 pilot Major General Greg Feast, F-15C pilot Colonel Rico Rodriguez, Air Force Special Operations Rep Colonel Randy O'Boyle, and Mr. Dale Burton, who is the technical lead for the J-STARS. We've also got Mitchell Dean, Lieutenant General Dave Deptula with us to provide the planning perspective, the man who is tasking these guys with their various missions from headquarters. Well, gentlemen, thank you all so much for being here. And to kick this off, General Deptula, I've got to ask you this. From the planning perspective, could you please provide a quick summation of the initial air campaign plan and what you are trying to achieve with the various strike packages?
Well, yes, Slick. I tell you what, the opening 24-hour attack was a very intricate plan that had been created over the prior 5 months, but it was adjusted hourly. Sometimes even more than that, all the way up to about 12 hours prior to execution. And it's really difficult to describe the intensity of the plan as well as the work that went into it. It certainly was the most demanding endeavor I've ever experienced in my lifetime. Now, stealth played a huge role as we were counting on their entry into Iraq in a covert fashion to shut down Iraq's air defenses by blinding their ability to detect the follow-on attacks, and also to attack strategic nodes to isolate and paralyze any coherent response by Iraq's leadership. We also used cruise missiles to assist in taking out perhaps the most leveraged target set of all, that being electric power production and distribution. Our air-to-air folks were tasked to look for and shoot down Saddam's command and control aircraft if he elected to use it to escape. Airfields were being disabled by B-52s and Scud launch sites attacked by F-15Es and others. F-16s and A-10s took on the Republican Guard, beginning their demise. Now, I could go on for hours. In fact, I've got a four-hour brief on this, but I'll spare you. In summary, there were 30 different types of Air Force aircraft alone that were involved. Nearly 3,000 total sorties were flown that first 24 hours, and over 1,800 of those were direct combat sorties. We had 161 tankers airborne that first night. 161. And we'd not practiced that gaggle prior to that first night. I tell you what, I was more concerned about losses from mid-airs than I was about the Iraqi air defense threats. So when we got word at the end of the first wave that there were no losses, we were ecstatic. In fact, in the entire first 24-hour period, we lost only one aircraft. Our plan worked, and in fact, has been characterized as the most successful air campaign in history. The bottom line is that the opening attacks of Desert Storm air campaign were a radical departure in the conduct of war. Over 150 discrete targets, in addition to regular Iraqi army forces and surface-to-air missile sites, made up the master attack plan for the opening 24 hours. The coalition attacked more targets in Desert Storm's first day than the entire 8th Air Force hit over the course of 2 years in World War II. Never before in history had as many separate targets been attacked in less time than in Desert Storm. The results were paralysis, confusion, and a rapid defeat of Saddam Hussein's gambit into Kuwait. Now, it all involved much more than the combat aircraft, though. It was truly an integrating effort involving airlift, refueling, command and control, crew chiefs, weapon loaders, squadron intel folks, cooks, and many others, who, while primarily from the U.S. Air Force, the air arms of the other services as well, as many partner nations were involved too, and our success is a tribute to all who participated. Now, given that we had a lot riding on stealth, let's hear what was on the mind of the F-117 pilot who was the first to drop a bomb on Iraq. Retired Major General Greg Feast. Beast, over to you.
Well, thanks, General Deptula. I thought I would talk about the first day of Operation Desert Storm and what I experienced. So the day started. Usually we worked out in the mornings and went into the squadron around 1 o'clock in the afternoon. On January 16th, we were told, stay in crew rest, don't come in till 1600. So we all thought, well, something's up because that's not normal. We got to the squadron at 1600 and we sat in the mass brief and listening to the intelligence update, the weather update, and then looking at our target folders, we all realized that we were actually going into Iraq for the night's missions. So we spent the next hour, couple of hours preparing for the target's runs and looking at our photos. And then later that evening, myself and my wingmen got in our jets and taxied out to the end of the runway. We had our bombs armed. We were carrying GBU-27s. Those are the 2,000-pound bunker busters that we carried on the 117. They were penetrators. And the only issue with them is they had to be dropped below 10,000 feet. We didn't think that was a big deal at the time. So we took the runway, took off without talking on the radios. We were completely blacked out. Beacons had been taken off our jets, and we were ready to go. And now habit patterns set in. We just flew the missions like we had practiced during Operation Desert Shield. Many nights we had taken off, joined on tankers without using radios, and then flown up to the Iraqi border and flown on the tanker's wing to desensitize the Iraqis so that when this first night was actually going to happen, they wouldn't become concerned seeing that we were flying along the border. So we did that. We took off, we rejoined, then we went and rejoined with the tanker, took gas, and I got in the left wing and got ready for my 90-minute sortie flight up to the Iraqi border. Once we got there, I based everything off timing. My TOT, my time over target, was 0251, which was 9 minutes before actual H hour. So I de-stealthed the aircraft before I came off the tanker. This meant doing a few things, but in particular, sucking in the antennas. So I can no longer talk to anyone or hear anyone. So until I got back into Saudi Arabia, I would be completely communications out and be on my own. I left the tanker, crossed the border, and now I flew my planned route, and I concentrated on finding my initial point and doing my target run. As I did the target run, I identified the target. It was an interceptor operations center, an IOC. My goal was to take out that target so that the non-stealthy aircraft, which General Deptula talked about earlier, could get across the border into Iraq without being detected. So this was an important target for everybody else that was coming in non-stealthy aircraft. So around 15 seconds before TOT, I identified the target and I had one last concern. Do they really want me to drop this bomb and start this war? Well, little did I know at the time, but the Tomahawks had already launched and the Apache helicopters had already taken out radar vans along the Iraqi border. So it was concerning to me, but at the time it didn't really matter. So I identified the target, dropped the bomb, the bay doors opened, bomb came off, bay doors closed, all within 5 seconds, realizing that while those doors were open, I was no longer stealthy and I could be tracked. So the quicker, the better. I tracked the target for 30 seconds, watched a bomb hit the bunker. I knew it hit and went off because the vents blew out smoke. Immediately after seeing the target hit, I started a 180-degree left turn. And as I did that turn, I looked back. My wingman was 1 minute behind me. I wanted to watch his bomb hit. Well, when I looked back, I saw something strange. I couldn't tell if the bunker had exploded or what was going on, but I saw these red flashes coming at me. I soon realized this was AAA, and these were the tracers. Now, we had talked about AAA and red flag, and we all said, yeah, we want to, you know, stay out of AAA. We want to avoid it. But it was all talk and no action back then. Well, now, having seen it for the first time, I was concerned. So I stopped looking back. I looked in front of the jet, pushed the throttles up as far as I could, which was mil power in a 117. We didn't have afterburner, which I wish I had at the time. I tried to climb as fast as I can and get out of the heart of the AAA. So once I did, I was relieved. And now I just hoped that my wingman was going to make it out as well. So I looked out in front of the aircraft. I was going towards my next target, and I saw the biggest fireworks demonstration I had ever seen. I saw SAMs, I saw AAA, and again, I started to worry because my next target was right in that demonstration, that fireworks demonstration, I call it. And like I said earlier, it wasn't like I could come in at high altitude above the AAA. We had to be below 10,000 feet to drop those GBU-27s. So I went into the target area, not thinking I'd make it out. Said a few things into my tape. I don't know what happened to that tape, but I'd like to hear it sometime if it's still around. Went in, hit the sector operation center, which was my second target. Watched the bomb hit, watched it go off, and again started a turn back towards Saudi Arabia. Pushing the throttles up to mil, trying to climb out of the AAA as fast as possible. So I headed back towards Saudi Arabia, and now we would find out what the true value of stealth is. As I neared the border of Saudi, I put the antennas back out, and at a set time, I checked in with my wingman. I was relieved when he answered me. I knew he had made it out of both target areas as well. I had a kneeboard on my right knee, and on it, I had a list of all the call signs and pilots that were flying in that first wave. I decided to listen for them to check in, and as I heard their names, I put a check next to it. After 20 minutes, I looked at the kneeboard and realized that all of us, I had a check mark next to everybody's name, all of us were coming home. So now it was just going to be whether or not we had battle damage or whether or not we could actually make it back to our home base. So my wingman and I took our gas and settled in for the flight home. It was non-eventful, but once we got back on the ground, we looked at our aircraft. No damage. The maintainers came out, examined all the stealth fighters. At the end of it, we found out that there was no damage to any of our fighters in that first wave. We were, again, relieved. We started to believe in stealth technology. However, I was going into the mission planning cell that night to plan missions for the next day, and that didn't bother me at all. Normally, I had wanted to fly every night, but having seen what I saw that first night, I was ready to go into the mission planning cell for a night. After three or four nights, though, we realized all our aircraft were coming home without any battle damage. Stealth technology worked. And just like before, we were all begging to get back into the fight. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks, Beast. That was great. Now, while much depended on the stealth F-117s that we had hitting critical targets all over Iraq, we were also relying on our F-15Cs right up front that were tasked against some critical command and control aircraft, and one aircraft in particular that we had some intel that Saddam might use to escape. Turns out he didn't, but it didn't matter. The Eagle folks were standing by and ready. Now, Rico Rodriguez was from the 33rd Fighter Wing and who racked up two MiG kills in Desert Storm. Rico, what were your thoughts that first night? And could you tell us a bit about the circumstances that surrounded your MiG kills?
Yes, sir, General Dotula and fellow warriors, I want to thank you for the opportunity. And I'll be honest with you, I always explained to the young kids who I talked to today that first night when I strapped on the jet, I had white underwear. And when I landed, I had a brown streak. It was scary. But more importantly, there was an amazing focus on the flight line. an amazing focus across the entire team at Tobok Air Base as we were now finally putting our mettle to the test. And so, you know, the team really stepped it up. There was nervousness across the board. There was crazy anxiety across the board. But just like any other scenario, and as Beast alluded to, once you got into your comfort zone of what you were used to doing from back home or Nellis at Red Flag or where you were at, once it became your comfort zone, then things came together. You know, as you alluded to, night one, after we looked on the radars, it was very clear that the biggest fear in the early stages was a midair. We could see all of the friendly AAI hits all over the sky. Your altitude block and stay there and hunker down and get as skinny as you could was the thinking to get to your tanker and head off. The night didn't go as some would remember. We didn't have those clear fields of fire that we thought were going to be available. All of those were part of the fog of war. And I think really, when you think about it, what diffuses that fog of war? Truly, in my opinion, you know, events like Red Flag diffused the fog of war and really gave you a comfort of where to go. Squadron leadership diffused the fog of war. We were lucky in our squadron. We had five patch wearers and one U.S. Navy Top Gun squadron graduate. So we had an incredible depth of squadron experience that really led the entire squadron through a variety of emotional roller coasters to be ready for first night as we got ready to go. And I'll be honest with you too, if it wouldn't have been for the guys like Colonel Tuna Hardy and Sharon Teal, squadron commander's wife back at home, knowing that back at home were under control made it easier to execute night one. And so that's kind of the feeling of the night one scenario. When we talk about the opportunities to engage the MIGs, the first and foremost, I based everything off of the training that we did. On the 19th of January, we engaged. We were tasked initially as a defensive counter air mission, and we rotated into an offensive counter air post strike sweep based on some intel that obtained some data on a potential munition storage area, which in fact it did turn out to be, because the effects of the bombs on target was truly another display of fireworks that I had never seen in my life. But my wingman and I, Mole, when we were in our post-strike sweep run, we found two MIGs that were coming out of the north in our long-range sweep, and they were coming out of Baghdad. As we were starting to sort that MIG formation, and they were very succinct in their tactics. They resembled what our aggressors did to us at Nellis. And sound radar discipline and sound formation flying is really how we were able to track them through their maneuvers and actually watch them, quote, pulling us into the IADs, which we did not realize we were being pulled into the IADs. As we were being pulled into the IADs, and now the WR was all lit, as well as Moles like Christmas tree, it was the Western AWACS, who was my original controller for the 4.5 hours of my DCA mission. It was him, Boner White, on guard, who called out the MIGs who had swept our 3-9 line and were now 8 miles off of my left wing. When Boner made that call, I immediately turned to 0330, punched off my tanks, put auto guns out there, found the MIG, and lo and behold, I found them, but I also had a rule of engagement conflict. Anything inside of 10 miles had to be VID. Something that changed the next day after we communicated that to you and your team, so thank you for the swift action. But unfortunately, I went defensive right off the bat because the MIG found me as well. And I went from about 35,000 feet down to about 500 feet in a pure vertical split with chaff flying off the jet. And my wingman then took the role of locking and targeting the lead MiG. He employed an AIM-7 off that lead MiG, which, oh boy, just happened to be when that explosion took off, happened about 3.5 to 4 miles off my right wing. I was arcing my spike, if you will, to keep him taking a shot on me. Boner again came up on guard and said there was another MiG to the north. The MiG to the north, we had two choices. He was 10 miles away, according to the AWACS scope, so that meant could have been 7, could have been 13. We really weren't sure. So we opted to go into the fight and go after that MiG. I was down at 500 feet, and Mole was up in the mid-high 20s. We bracketed vertically. I was able to try and get a VID on him, but I'll be honest with you, from about 7 to 8 miles, I had ID looking through the TD box. He looked like every friendly fighter that we had in the coalition. So I was not to take a shot without a positive ID. I merged off of his left wing about 50 to 75 feet. I was able to confirm a green silhouette with an Iraqi flag, called Bandit, and started in a classic two-circle fight. Except this circle fight had live weapons on both sides. So I was not sure how it was going to turn out. My crew chief said that the several times that I pulled in excess of G's didn't do very bad to the jet. So the jet did a great job of handling that event. After about three 360 turns with the jet, with the MiG ended up in a less than offensive position, i.e., he was in my gun sight. I didn't have a gun plan. I had actually an AIM-9 plan. When I pulled lead to get a tone, the MiG automatically started into what I call his last-ditch maneuver, and his last-ditch maneuver didn't allow him really to clear the ground. He hit in the desert with afterburners cooking, and then Mole and I exited the fight to the south shortly thereafter. Mole and I said about 10 words to each other in that entire engagement. We had been flying as a paired two-ship and a four-ship for the last 3.5 months. We could almost sense what each other was thinking. That was critical on the foundation of the training that we learned at Nellis at Red Flag to go forward. So Lady Luck was on our side, but truly the foundation that we encountered, that we learned at places like Nellis, homegrown DACT at Eglin and other places really got us prepared to win that fight. Over.
Hey, thanks, Rico. That's a great summary.
Jaramola, can you talk to us about the unique role the long-range strike played in this war? What unique capabilities did you bring to the fight, and why was this so important?
Well, thanks, Lick. I'm really happy to have the opportunity to talk to you about Desert Storm. I still can't believe that it was 30 years ago, but the lessons that we learned that back in the day, I think, are applicable and so important to today's and future fights. The B-52s, the bomber force, demonstrated long-range and heavy payload capabilities that the bombers bring to the fight on night one of Desert Storm in multiple ways. So I'll take you back to when 7 B-52s loaded with the new secret weapon, a conventional air-launched cruise missiles launched from Barksdale Air Force Base, flew nonstop to the Middle East on the first true global power mission to strike targets after the initial wave of aircraft had come off their targets in Iraq. Launched at precisely the right moments after that 14.5-hour ingress, the CALCOMs avoided the aircraft leaving the Iraq. They arrived over the targets mid-morning, and they destroyed and damaged infrastructure targets like the electrical grid and comms nodes. When it was over, the crews flew 14,000 miles, 35 hours, without landing, the longest combat sortie ever at the time. So the conversion of nuclear air-launched cruise missiles into conventional cruise missiles, it was a game changer for the air campaign and especially for the bomber force. B-52s demonstrated all of the advantages of the bomber fleet: rapid response, long range, heavy payloads, and precision standoff weapons delivery. B-52s that were deployed forward provided the Air Component Commander with operational and tactical flexibility in different ways. First, To maintain surprise and to avoid detection from the Iraqi air defenses, for the first three nights of the war, the forward bomber units flew low-level missions as two or three ship formations against strategic targets like the dispersal airfields in western Iraq, as well as other strategic targets like command centers. The crews flew exactly as they'd been trained for years. But in the next phase of the air war, the B-52s transitioned to flying high-altitude sorties up at 37,000 to 41,000 feet with formations that ranged from 3 aircraft to 8 aircraft. And the targeting strategy also changed. Instead of just conducting strikes on strategic facilities, the bombers began to attrit and destroy the Republican Guard, creating pathways through the Iraqi minefields in preparation for the ground forces advance, and attacks on large area targets. One example of this type of mission occurred during the third week of the war. I had the unique opportunity to lead an eight-ship B-52 formation that essentially transitioned or simultaneously attacked the huge Taji missile storage facilities north of Baghdad. And what the way it occurred essentially is that there were three B-52 bases, a formation of eight B-52s took off from each of those bases. We converged over the Taji missile facilities and completely destroyed this huge area target in the span of approximately 15 to 20 minutes. It was an amazing example of how the flexibility of the bomber, what the bombers bring to the fight.
Orville, let's turn to you. You were a squadron commander at the time, and I recall bringing Secretary of the Air Force Don Rice by to visit your squadron in Desert Shield. Desert Storm, by design, was a far different war than Vietnam. Could you share how you approached your leadership role at the time, pushing to really ensure that we had the right mindset amongst all the squadron pilots heading into this war from a unit level?
You bet. Thanks, Dave, and an honor to be with all those on the net here today. Let me talk about mindset just a bit and unit level. So going to war at the unit level. First, we didn't know, I don't think anybody much knew with lead time that we were going to have 24 F-16s in gutter because of geopolitical Congress opposition to the government of gutter for a number of reasons. Had it not been for the then U.S. ambassador to gutter, we would have never been able in a short notice way to open up Doha International to 24 F-16s. So we showed up in August to a bare base, essentially. There was no preparation. We thought we were going to be in pretty good shape because we were moved immediately to the Doha Sheraton, highly defended by every cop in gutter and most of the military. And General Schwarzkopf, in about two nights, said, not so fast, out of the hotel for force protection reasons, find a place to sleep. Well, that was the ramp and a condemned hangar for about a month and a half. We built our tent city close to the runway where we could keep flying, and we never stopped flying during that time. We ate MREs, and we built what I'd like to talk about is the bomb dump story, weapon storage area. I'm not sure this story's ever been told, so here you go. When you got to build your own bomb dump, who knows? How do you do that? Well, we had a wonderful senior master sergeant who was chief of the weapons load team, and he says, I built a bomb dump. I know how to do this. So, okay, where to put the bomb dump? Well, close to the runway. So we did that without a lot of planning. And my provisional wing commander really gave this deployed squadron commander a lot of authority to build this warfighting capability that included tent city and a bomb dump and everything else we were doing, including ownership of the maintainers to the squadron commander. So in building the weapons storage area, I relied on my senior master sergeant who'd done one of these before. I drove the D-10 a little bit to build the berms. And we had our weapon storage area all put together in short order. Enter the young captain who is the weapons safety inspector flown in from Torrejon, who told us we had to move our bomb dump. It was too close to the tent city. Because of the size of aggregate in the berms, we were going to risk what we were doing if we had an inadvertent detonation inside the berms and the bomb dump. Short discussion, go away, our bomb dump's where we want it, it's right next to the runway. And long story short, we dropped A lot of metrics associated with weapons store with the Desert Storm. Here's one for you. One F-16 unit dropped 2 million pounds of bombs in 38 days, 2 million pounds. General Schwarzkopf, General Horner actually visited, he goes, you know, you guys put this bomb dump exactly where it needs to be, close to the runway. And not much whining in the tent city, because they were close to the runway, not a long commute. By the way, there were options to all this, as you can imagine. 2-hour bus rides, you know, trucking bombs from 3 miles away, a whole bunch of dumb stuff that didn't happen because we had a provisional wing commander and General Chuck Horner who said, hey, this is about going to war. And so really the mindset of the whole 401st Provisional Wing was all focused on launching sorties. As far as flying went, we showed up and very well hosted by the Gutter Emiri Air Force F1 unit and a small detachment of French F1s. And incredible flying, as good a flying training as any place I've ever been. Every day we launched, we had F1s for adversary air. We integrated forces with them. The Canadians eventually showed up. So it was very much a composite provisional wing. And here's another story that may not be told. One day, the French, young French major, who was the detachment commander flying F1s, Mirage F1s, walked in with this big book, 3-ring binder. And he said, well, on our own, and by the way, they had an English only spoken sign over their squadron deck. I mean, these were good guys. So whatever you want to say bad about the French, when you start flying with the French, they are good guys. And so on their own, they'd gone back to Paris, the Mirage factory, and they gave us every tail number of every Iraqi F1. And all the specs, all the radar mods, they even had Remora jamming pod information. And so we took this information and we sent out to everybody we knew. Rico, I don't know if you got it or not, but we tried to send it to everybody at the squadron level. Turns out DIA was trying to do some high-priced exploitation study of an Australian F1. We had it all, thanks to our friends, French friends. And after about a week and multiple copies of that 3-ring binder on every tail number, the Iraqi, Mirage F1 tail number of the Iraqi zone, we sent this big 3-ring binder to Riyadh, never to be seen again. Who knows where all that information was, but it's a great testament to the friendships among fighter pilots and warriors when you get ready to go to war. And so, Dave, I'll let everybody talk a little bit more. I got a couple more stories about General McPeak showing up and dropping bombs. Well, I'll just tell this story. I got a couple more minutes. Again, never to be told, maybe never to be repeated. I don't know. So the Gutteries were very interested in everything to do with the F-16 cockpit, and they went right to the PAL and ABLE switchology. And as you all know, we were ready, more than ready, to drop B-61. In fact, I still had two guys sitting alert at Aviano in up through October of 90, ready to drop bombs, drop B-61s as needed in the former Warsaw Pact. And so the Gutteries are asking all these questions about PAL and ABLE switching and B-61 capability. And of course, our standard answer, we're trained, is we can neither confirm nor deny. We can neither confirm nor deny. That was what you say if you're a new qualified. Well, conversation goes from there. And I don't know exactly what I said, but it was along the lines to my Gutter Emiri Air Force counterpart. Now, please let Saddam Hussein know, or anybody else in this theater, that while we can neither confirm or deny nuclear capability, we are all trained to drop B-61s. And so if there's any hint of chemical, biological, or radiological warfare against anybody here in Gutter, you just need to know that we are highly trained to respond. Who knows where that information went, but war story here told. I've only had one beer, and what an honor again to be with this group and think back on what we did. And oh, by the way, in closing, Dave Deptula has got a son, and I've got a daughter who are about third graders when this was all going on, and they're still flying and fighting today. And in fact, have flown together over places from the Horn of Africa to Libya, to Syria, to Iraq, to Afghanistan. The war has never stopped, and we have never come home. What an incredible story about the bravery, the courage, the selfless commitment of airmen.
You know, that's awesome, Orville. Really appreciate those insights. They're very good. Okay, Randy. Randy O'Boyle was instrumental in designing the initial attack of the electronic warning listening post to allow a flight of F-15Es get into Iraq 20 minutes prior to bombs on Baghdad. Randy, tell us a little bit about this and some of the other roles of Air Force Special Operations.
Well, just to show you how integrated Air Force Special Operations is with the rest of the Air Force, here I am sitting with a bunch of fast mover guys, because you know I'm a low in the mud kind of knuckle dragger, 50 old Pavlo 53. You know you're old when all the airplanes you flew were retired. But I think the thing was, at the time we had just come out of Just Cause in Panama, and that was pretty successful for us. And then, you know, I kind of went over to Wing Plans, and next thing you know, everybody's beeper at Fort Bragg went off where we were with the customers, and here we are, student body riding. We're with the big Air Force. I mean, is where I ended up, because one of the missions we were Air Force Special Ops was detailed over to Sauksent, and our mission was combat search and rescue in that theater at that time in support of any Army Special Ops missions. And so we were drawing up the combat rescue plan for the theater, which was very important. And remember, it was just the defense of Saudi Arabia. So we rolled in like everybody else and tried to find space. And we were in the basement of the Saudi air building, and found ourselves in a telephone closet, putting maps on the walls, trying to make space and doing CSAR. And a guy named Steve Wilson came up to me, and he was a fast mover, I think an F-15 guy, might have been working at the White House or someplace. But, you know, he had a lot of gravitas, and he came by and asked me what I was doing. And I said, well, I'm doing the combat search and rescue plan for the theater. And he looked at my maps and he goes, well, what are all those orbit points? Those look like they're in Iraq. I go, well, yeah. He goes, well, no, this is a defense of Saudi Arabia. I said, yeah, but I mean, come on, coach, if they're going to come whack us, we're going to throw the ball, right? And he looked at me and laughed. He says, you come with me. And I took my map and I went up. The next thing you know, I was introduced to Lieutenant Colonel Deptula and General Glosson after we passed through this guard. And I got written into the whole, the black hole scenario, which was a pretty high energy place with a bunch of people breaking all of the norms and all of the rules. And I loved it, because that's what, you know, special ops guys, we kind of do that probably more often than some. But I think now culturally it's done every day in the Air Force. I think they're breaking norms and breaking rules. And I walked into this air power centric, you know, you could call it a cave in some respects, but there's a bunch of people out there working for the war. And so everybody started, you know, I got integrated and I was working on the combat rescue plan. And we knew, we'd done some analysis. We knew it might be like linebacker two, and we might have 125 guys on the ground, and we got to figure out a way to get them. And we were doing forward orbit points, you know, west of Baghdad and places, because we knew we didn't have a lot of time to hide, and we had to go in and get them right now, or we wouldn't get them. Well, long story short, Tron, Gary Alexander, an EF-111 guy, great guy, beeps and squeaks, came to me, and he was showing me this layout of these radar sites along the border and the perplexing problems that they were going to have trying to avoid detection after the 117s had crossed. And he goes, you know, if I could just get rid of a couple of these, there's a big corridor right there. I mean, that'd buy me some time. And I said, well, you know, I can do that. I mean, we can do that. And he goes, how? I said, well, you know, they're right on the border. And so we can have the ground guys in. That's not far at all. They can get in there like unplugging a TV. They'll just go dark. And then, you know, we'll take care of everybody. But just, you know, that'll be it. So that became part of the plan. We briefed it to Colonel Deptula and General Glosson. And, okay, that's good. I guess, you know, keep planning. So we did. Well, that went for a while. And then the Army guys used that situation to order every single Jeep and Stinger and thing known to man. And that got, I think Schwarzkopf, you know, I'm just a captain. I can remember getting yelled at a little bit about that, but I had no control. Anyway, long story short, they moved that about those sites 50 miles back from the border. And so an E&E on the ground to maintain security, that just wasn't going to happen. So the guys at Al-5 there and working with the Apaches came up with a plan to lead them in. The Apaches couldn't get there really in the dark, in that kind of a dark night on their flares, and because they didn't have terrain avoidance radar. Pavlo was designed for hostile penetration of enemy airspace at low level with the terrain following system. It worked really well, and we'd used it many years on a lot of special ops missions. So we led the Apaches in. And people say, well, why'd you do that? I mean, did you really need to do that? Well, these radar sites were kind of scattered over, you know, a number, a click and a half or two. You just couldn't drop one bomb necessarily and take these all out anyway. And more importantly, we were doing things culturally that you know, it was the right thing to do. If we saved a couple F-15Es and a couple of those guys, or, you know, maybe even more, it was worth doing. And it worked as planned. The guys did a fantastic job, and it all came about. I mean, we were trying to be value added. It was a good play. You know, sometimes people say, well, you didn't need to do that, or you didn't need to do that, or, you know, make more of it than it was, but it was smart to do. And I think it was effectively orchestrated. And I was overhead that night. I was telling Rico, we had creeped on the ABCCC controlling that mission, and then the CSAR later on if needed. And we popped our nose into Iraqi airspace just because we could, which proved to be a completely stupid idea, because we weren't 5 or 10 miles into Iraq on this ABCCC, you know, along when those two of those MiGs that Rico's guys whacked had taken off from Talil or wherever they did, and were right at it. We were getting calls from the AWACS. We're screaming out of the sky, and I know these guys aren't flying night vision goggles, and I'm sitting in the back of this thing, and I'm just thinking I'm going to die in a box. I mean, this is just unglorious. And then I'm waiting for the guys to go for their parachutes, but nobody went for their parachutes. And I think, well, I'm the special ops guy. I mean, this, I'd be ridiculed for that. I'm unmanly, and so I'll just die in the box, you know? So those are the things that happened, but special ops tried to be value added. We did do CSAR. We picked up some guys, Tom Trask, got a Navy pilot back to the carrier and turned that guy around in you know, 24 hours. He was back flying missions. We weren't successful all the time because of the density of the aircraft there, but I think we did what needed to be done. And we also dropped Blue 82s out of C-130s, which, you know, I can remember we had the video back in the black hole. The Brits were seeing, exclaiming that the Yanks had lost their bleeding minds because they just dropped a nuke. But, you know, if you're on the receiving end of a Blue 82, but we did some scud hunting later on in support of keeping, you know, the Israelis out of the conflict. And that was a big deal. So, you know, we had a lot of an interesting missions and we tried to be value added. And I think now, you know, AFSOC is such a fully integrated arm of the Air Force and it was a real joint and combined planning effort. It wasn't just the Air Force, but General Deptula, who was Lieutenant Colonel Deptula, man, he was a force to be reckoned with. And you didn't cross. I mean, I was a captain, but I'd rather cross General Glosson than I would rather cross Dave Deptula at the time, because he looked down at you, you know, like if you said something that the general didn't really need to hear, you know, he'd kind of give you that look. But it was good because it kept us all moving. But on the bomb story that Orville talked about, I can remember Horner, and, you know, young captain to be able to see all this air power, it was, you know, being ginned up was pretty spectacular. But Glosson and Horner were talking to each other, and they were having a problem getting bombs, and the logistics guys wanted to, well, no, you know, we'll get them, but we don't have enough room for them. And they both came unglued and said, look, we flew with just one or two bombs on our wing in Vietnam, and that's not going to happen again. And I don't care if it takes 3 years to get all these bombs back home. I don't care whatever happens to them. And I want them there. And I was wide eyed, and I'm going, man, I'm glad I'm not that colonel. So, you know, there's a lot of those. It was generationally different. They did remember what happened to them, and they weren't going to let that happen again. And they weren't going to fight that same war the same way because they knew they had the technology to win on all fronts. So that's my story.
Thanks, Randy. If you can tell, Randy was a force to be reckoned with himself. I have some great stories about him. And our excursion up into Talil the day after the fighting stopped. But in the interest of time, I'm not going to tell that now. You have to wait for the book to come out. Yeah. Okay, we're going to turn to Mr. Dale Burton. And Dale is got an incredible story here. Just a bit of background. JSTARS was still in its operational test and evaluation phase, and it had not been declared operational yet, but they were sent over to theater. And Dale actually flew on JSTARS during the Kofte incursion, as well as on the Mother of All Retreats mission. So Dale, tell us a bit, and if you can, summarize what the significance of having JSTARS in Desert Storm was.
Well, yes, sir. And first, I'd like to thank you and the folks tracking me down. I recently retired, talking about 30 years, 30 years ago. I was 35, and I happened to be the chief engineer for the Joint STARS weapon system. And probably one of my proudest things in my career is I was the second person within our company to know that the United States government wanted to pull Joint STARS out of deployment and send it to what was then Desert Shield and then what turned into Desert Storm And on December 17th, 1990, I was called down to the president's office. And he said, Dale, I just got a call from the government. And they said they'd like to make a constructive change to the contract and send two airplanes, or two development airplanes, to Iraq and be there by the 15th of January or don't come. Now, we had just done a two-month operational field demonstration in Europe, which really led, I'm told, later, after I got to meet folks like General Deptula and General Horner, General Quarter, that it was really our exercise and operational field demonstration with 7th Corps Commander, Lieutenant General Freddie Franks, 7th Corps Commander, who requested Joint Stars. Now, at that time, in December 17th, we had never flown two airplanes at the same time. We had two test airplanes. One of them didn't even have a in-flight refueling system in it. We didn't even have enough hardware to field two airplanes. So it became an industry government team like was very proud to be part of, because we took our industry partners. And the one thing about Joint Stars is that was significant to me was it was truly joint then. A lot of people don't know about the Army component of Joint Stars with ground stations that were with 7th Corps up at King Khalid Military City. We get a lot of credit at time for flying on the airplane, but I had people on the ground up with these Army units. And so make a long story short, we had to get the second airplane ready to go. We flew 19 times in 25 days in Florida and deployed. We left on the 11th of January, landed in Riyadh on the 12th of January, stood down on the 13th and began operations on the 14th of January. And we flew 49 combat missions in 49 days. And, you know, you kind of don't go to try to set a record. My biggest issue was, had we overstated what a Joint Stars would do? The significance of Joint Stars is best told by the warfighter, in my opinion, from their perspective. The impact of the war on Joint Stars is something I can probably comment a little bit on. Because, again, Joint Stars was a vision, and somebody had put it in one of the read-aheads about what took place in the 70s and the 80s. The visionaries that said a system like Joint Stars that could do wide area, real-time surveillance and battle management. STARS stands for Surveillance Target Attack Radar System. And so a ragtag unit got put together of the Joint Test Force, of the Air Force, the Army, former TAC people. Our commander was Colonel George Mulner, who went on to become Lieutenant General Mulner. And our ops commander was our JTF commander, Colonel Royce Gronis. And those two individuals put together a unit that I considered almost MASH-like. I mean, it was contractors. We had an Australian exchange officer from the Army on one of our crews. He had lost a leg in Vietnam. He had a peg leg. Pat Scanlon was his name, Captain Pat Scanlon. We originally started with two crews. We eventually went to three because Colonel Mueller said we were flying too much. But so we flew every night, and there were a lot of things. Our primary role was to keep the system up and running. It was very fragile. One of the facts of it is it didn't meet, I don't think, any spec that we were on contract for at the time in terms of surveillance rate, surveillance coverage. I happen to have a radar background, so I always like to tell people radars really put up a few things. They put up real targets, false targets, and then don't put up targets when you should. And so we were doing all three of those things real time. The significance of the vision of Joint Stars by those folks, Dr. Perry, Dr. Kaminsky, former military folks involved in all of that. And then Nort Grumman's won the contract to build it. You had the inventor of our version of Joint Stars, a guy named Jerry McNiff, over there on that deployment. So I never had to worry about what it was supposed to do from a architectural design point of view. I just kind of had to worry about, could we keep it running with the hardware we had, with the people we had. We had, like I said, three crews, 17 air members that flew. There was a blue crew and a silver crew, and eventually what I call the infamous black crew. And our two roles were to keep the system running and then explain to people what it does and how it does it and what works and what doesn't work, because people had read books on what it was supposed to do, but some of that was still not done. As General Deptula said, we were still in development. So one of the things that Colonel Molnar did was he flew a variety of people from other units on our airplane to see what a Joint STARS was and what it did, because nobody really understood that we could survey the entire country of Kuwait in about a minute, that at a particular resolution with our ground moving target indication. Yeah, there were a lot of things that weren't real on that display, but when it was real, when you see a 4 kilometer, 10 kilometer column, you even see an individual target moving coherently down a road, the operators very quickly, the warfighter, the experts at understanding not just what you see, but why you're seeing what you're seeing. We were a joint army. There were 3 army individuals on every crew. We only had 10 consoles. We, the contractor, took 1, and that left 9 for the other folks. Their general or Colonel Molnar at the time got an ace. I didn't know what an ace was. It was never part of the command structure for the airplane in the proposal and in what we were building, but an air command element authority, which meant something. And for a guy like me, a civilian, it was not a whole lot. But for me and my crews, both on the air and in the ground, and equally importantly, after the missions, General Deptula may remember, we built Macintoshes that could take our history files and we would bring them over into the command center there in Saudi Riyadh, and they could look at the historical data. When we flew the F-15 folks that were flying out of Al-Kars, they wanted us to move down and fly out of that base with them. Now, we were living at Escon Village, and we kind of said, well, that's not as good a trade for us, I guess. But we didn't get a vote, and they didn't move us anyway. And we were a bunch of civilians they were having difficulty dealing with at times, I suspect. So we're very proud of the fact that going into Desert Storm, we were a system put together for the mass invasion of Europe through the Fulda Gap by the Russians. The wall came down in 88, and we were going to be a peace dividend. And we had our OFD, and a bunch of my people went to Berlin, got hats and rocks and all this stuff. And the future of Joint STARS was very much a question. If there's something that came out of it, it was that the need, the warfighter need, and while that need is there, this system has matured, evolved, and operates still to this day by the Guard here in Georgia. So I thank you for the opportunity to share an anecdote or two there. And it really validated for me the significance of Desert Storm on Joint STARS was the validation of what you folks as warfighter know, the things you need to do your job, and enabled us as contractors to be there with you to help, without interpretation, understand the relevance and importance of doing that and doing that as well as we can. So thank you very much.
Well, gentlemen, what incredible insights from all of you. Now, as we wrap up this series commemorating the 30th anniversary of Desert Storm, I'd like to go around the group and have each of you give one key lesson learned that you think needs to be reemphasized today. And General Feast, we'll start with you.
Yeah, besides the importance of air power, I'd like to talk a little bit about rapid acquisition with minimal oversight. The F-117 program came about in 31 months. It went from plans to first flight. And then we kept it in the black world for many years. That allowed us to get that aircraft rapidly and not have to make massive changes because too many people were watching the program. I think that the Air Force and our defense industry partners are doing a great job today as well. I think a rapid acquisition is helping. I think having a little less oversight would be beneficial. We've come out with the F-22, the F-35, the B-21, and now the next generation air dominance. And I think if Congress and the Pentagon allow us to continue to do what we need to do, our aircraft will come about faster and we can be ready to fight tomorrow's wars. Thank you.
I think the lesson, ultimate lesson learned, and the lesson that has allowed me to participate in follow-on combat operations after Desert Storm is train like you're going to fight. And we really, as a nation, cannot afford to not invest in every possible training opportunity, whether it be a learning application at PME, a learning opportunity virtual versus real at Nellis, or the NATO coalition type of events. We have to fund those, and we've got to put people and assets into those environments because that's where the comfort, if you will, of the night one, you know, the terror of night one comes from. And when you have that comfort, then you can perform to a high level.
Excellent, sir. Thank you so much. And over to you, General Mueller.
Well, on night one, my crew and I flew a B-52 two ship from Diego Garcia, which was a small island in the Indian Ocean I think everybody knows now. Our target was a dispersal fighter air base in western Iraq, critical to suppressing the ability of the Iraqis to respond to the air campaign. We operated lights out 500 feet over the desert. The airplanes were 30 seconds apart at night, carrying 52 500-pound weapons to a target we'd never seen before. None of us had flown in combat. Of the six crew members, the youngest was 23 and the oldest was 32. As we approached the target, we had to climb to 1,100 feet to make sure we didn't frag ourselves. The Iraqis started shooting AAA. We jinked, we maneuvered till the bomb run, where we had to stay straight and level for 45 seconds. They didn't stop shooting. We dropped our bombs successfully on time, on target, we headed for home. Entire mission, 17.8 hours. Our mission success, I'm convinced, was reinforced the critical importance of realistic training. We performed a 488,000-pound max gross weight takeoff, relying on our 8 Pratt & Whitney J57 water-injected engines to claw airborne. We accomplished 3 heavyweight com-out refuelings, lasting about 30 minutes on the boom. We flew a combat sortie of the mission at low level, 500 feet, for almost 4 hours, and destroyed the target with a full weapons release. The crew worked together as one team. We had complete confidence in each other. We knew each other's strengths and weaknesses, not scared, not nervous. We just fell back on our training. We trusted each other to do our job. We'd never done it for real. We flew the sortie as we practiced it 1,000 times before. As we look to the future for our Air Force, I believe we must do everything possible to realistically train in preparation for the next conflict across multiple domains against the most advanced adversaries. I'm convinced this is the key to flying, fighting, and winning against a peer competitor in a highly contested environment.
Thank you, General Mueller. Now over to you, General Wright.
I think, agile combat employment, there's a lot of training going on now to operate from bare bases. We certainly showed that we could. If there's a piece of concrete in the world, we can put jets in there. And with incredible maintenance warriors, if you will, and the relatively small support footprint we need, we can go to war anywhere in the world and carry the fight to the enemy. And we can survive to operate. We took plenty of protective gear against Scud attacks, and we can fight through those kind of attacks, especially as we go to multiple pieces of concrete from all over Japan to all over the Middle East to all over Europe, just like we're training to do today. So the agile combat employment concept works. The other point is every threat's a target. We killed a lot of SAMs, and we had no problem going to war with F-4Gs, integrated with our F-16s, and now today, Block 50 F-16s. Every radiating surface-to-air missile up to the level of today's S-400s is a target. They can't move out of the way very fast, and we should not have this approach that somehow an integrated air defense system creates some kind of anti-access aerial denial environment that we can't kill. Every threat, a target, and we'll operate from anywhere in the world, from any piece of concrete to do so.
Awesome, sir. All right, Colonel O'Boyle.
You can't be predictable and win. If you're predictable, then you know you run the odds of getting your rear end handed to you. And institutional wisdom isn't always helpful, and sometimes it's exactly the wrong thing, and bureaucracies have a tendency to be often wrong but never in doubt. And those are all things that you have to fight against every day to create new ways and new paradigms of doing it. And I think that's what the air campaign was. If we'd listened to the conventional wisdom that told us no every time, we'd have never achieved the success. A lot of people would have been killed that didn't you know, a lot of American troops would have been wasted. So my hat's off to everybody and at every level. It was great.
Excellent. And Dr. Burton.
Yes, sir. Well, I guess for me, it's that, as the gentleman said, there is a way for us to do things rapidly, commit to them, not overcommit. My biggest concern was, had we ever misrepresented to the leadership what two Joint Stars airplanes could do and contribute, being where they were in development, what we had done in an operational field demonstration, and not misled someone that they believed we would be able to contribute in a way that could get somebody else hurt because we didn't do our job. I'm told that when Grumman won the Joint Stars contract, their architecture was evaluated as and summarized as better a poorly thought out good idea than a well thought out bad idea. And I think Joint Stars, because of a guy like Jerry McNiff, who architected a system with great flexibility, and we were able to use that flexibility. We went over with 16 radios, but General Chubb had said early in acquisition we'd never get them to work, and we didn't. And we fought the war with four radios, UHF radios. And we went to production with 12. We started with 10 consoles. We went to 18. So I just think if the folks, and I know the warfighter that's at the pointy end of the spear does believe that the people that build these systems are willing to come join you in whatever way is necessary to help make them effective. Thank you very much.
Let me add on just one more point, Slick. And that is very simple. It's a motto when you listen to Dale and J-Stars. You know, I talked about 2 million pounds of bombs employed by one squadron of F-16s. The enemy cannot run. They can hide in some cases, but they cannot run. Once they run, we kill them. And that is all about air power as the asymmetric advantage to destroy ground armies. We range the entire battlefield and they could hide, but they could not run. And if they tried to run or maneuver, we killed them.
Thank you for that. And General Deptula.
Yeah, Slick, here you go, short and sweet. Airmen need to be able to strongly and effectively advocate for aerospace options that exploit the virtues and values of aerospace power. Because if they don't, nobody else will. That was key to Desert Storm, period, dot.
Well, gentlemen, I have to tell you, it has been an absolute honor to host all of you today. I want to thank you on a personal level because I'm one of the guys who entered the air combat realm a few years later. And I know whether I'm thinking about my time over Kosovo, Afghanistan, or Iraq, the operational path you defined was fundamental to me being equipped for success. And it doesn't stop there. The same holds for every airman strapping into a jet today. You guys defined how to do it right. Ladies and gentlemen, this wraps up our Desert Storm retrospective, but it will not be the end of our operational level discussions. A key aspect defining the aerospace advantage is a holistic view, looking at strategy, policy, technology, the flight line, and the space operations centers. So you can expect to see far more of these incredible dialogues, giving you a front row seat to see what it takes to give America its aerospace advantage. With that, fly safe and check 6.